I have given this talk in Stockholm, and then it took 1 hour. Last week, I gave it in München at the conference on quantum electronics, and it took 40 minutes. Today, it will take 30 minutes. Now, in case I miss certain points, or you miss certain points, I suggest you read the write-up in Science magazine, June 4 issue, or in the July issue of the Review of Modern Physics. The lasers were honored in 64, and Townes and Basov and Prokhorov at that time showed you the development of lasers from microwave spectroscopy. And it is the lasers that made possible the development of nonlinear optics. And I would also like to give some nonlinear antecedents, predecessors, which also derive from the area of radio frequency spectroscopy and magnetic resonance. But let me first remind you why the lasers opened up this field. Let's take the first laser, the ruby laser of Maiman. We have 1 cubic centimeter of ruby, which contains about 10 to the 18th chromium ions, and they can emit 10 to the 18th photons of red light, which amounts to the rather small amount of energy of 1/10 of a joule. That is the energy that a 100-watt light bulb consumes every millisecond. It's also the heat produced by a human body every millisecond. So it's a very tiny amount of energy. But we can concentrate these photons in space and in time. With the so-called Q-switched arrangement, it's very easy to make these 10 to the 18th photons come out in 10 to the minus 8 seconds. In fact, modern developments have made it possible to have them come out in 10 to the minus 13 seconds. So I'm not pushing things at all. The first laser can do this. Of course, since the light is diffraction limited, it could be focused on an area of lambda squared. I won't focus it that hard. I will focus it on an area 10 lambda in diameter, so that's 10 to the minus 6 square centimeters. And now if you have 1/10 of a joule in 10 nanoseconds in 10 to the minus 6 square centimeters, you get a peak power density of 10 to the 13 watts per square centimeter. And that is something very impressive. That is 10 terawatts. And 10 to the 12 watts equals the power output of all electric power generating stations on Earth. And imagine all that power on 1 square centimeter. Then clearly all hell breaks loose. And this is indeed the case. From Poynting's vector, we find that the electric field strength is 10 to the 8 volts per centimeter, so quite comparable to the electric fields inside the atoms and the molecules responsible for the binding of the valence electrons. So they are literally pulled out, and it is possible with such a very small laser to transform material to a plasma, either a high-Z X-ray plasma or a low-Z thermonuclear plasma. Now, clearly, non-linearities will start to become apparent long before we do something so destructive. I may remind, just as an amusement, say that I had a colleague not very well versed in the classics, and he said, oh, terawatt, that figures, that's the power output on Earth. But that is from the Latin terra with 2 R. This terawatt is spelled with 1 R, comes from the Greek word teras, meaning monstrosity, and it is really a monstrous amount of power that one can get. And even at much lower powers, one already finds that the response of material, and when I say material, I mean any amount of matter, even monatomic gases, is not strictly linear to the electric field amplitude, but the polarization gets nonlinear terms, quadratic cubic terms, and higher powers. But we won't need higher powers and higher nonlinearities in this talk. Now, already in Maxwell's times, electrical engineers were well aware of these nonlinearities. They used power transformers where you have a nonlinear relationship between the magnetization and the magnetic field, between B and H. And of course, they produce distortions of the sinusoidal signals. And so these terms, like the second order term, if I have an harmonic field in, I immediately get all the effects that any quadratic device gives. I get second harmonic generation, I get rectification, I get sum and difference frequency generation, and more complicated effects from the cubic term. Now, such nonlinearities were quite important in the field of magnetic resonance, and I may remind you, with Professor Bloch in the audience, of nuclear magnetic resonance in water. Proton spins one half, two energy levels. They come in thermal equilibrium by a relaxation mechanism, which we need not specify. But then if we drive them with an RF field, the RF field tries to equalize the population in these two levels and heat up the spin system essentially to a very high temperature. That phenomenon is called saturation, because then I get equal numbers of absorption processes and stimulated emission processes. So in general, we will wind up by the combined action of a pump and the heat bath relaxation mechanism with an intermediate temperature. And that means that the susceptibility is not the susceptibility at very low fields, but there will be a correction term due to incipient saturation, which is described by AAKI3. Now, the first manifestation of this sort of thing I like to show in a paper known as BPP, Purcell and Pound, where my colleagues, I was Purcell's student, of course, and here you see the proton resonance of water in a magnetic field, and in those early days, the line width was completely determined by the inhomogeneity in the magnet gap. And then if one puts the RF field so as to resonate with the protons at location A, one starts saturating only those protons. And so if a little time later one probes the field, one probes the proton spin polarization, one finds a saturation hole at that location. And the width of that hole is quite narrow, and this was the first indication of the very narrow resonances of magnetic spins, nuclear spins in liquids, which of course then led to the very vast application of magnetic resonance spectroscopy in chemistry and biology as we know it today. Of course, this hole disappears with the relaxation time T1, which we measured in 46 as 2.3 seconds in protons in water, and is still at that value. And of course, there the saturation dip disappears. But it's really a nonlinear effect. My colleague Pound soon made a variant of this by taking nuclear spin 3/2 of sodium. Then one has a quadrupole coupling and one has three resonant lines. And he saturated the central component and saw changes in the population of the adjacent two levels. This was an early indication of quadrupolar relaxation. Another variant, for which Professor Kassler here in the audience received the Nobel Prize, is that one makes one of the fields an optical field, and here one pumps, in this case it was angular momentum pumping, but it could also be a frequency selective pumping, that is not too much of a difference, as we now realize, between two optical levels. And then spontaneous emission goes back that way and that way. If they go back this way, they are pumped up again. So eventually, we build up a population there, and we can detect that with a RF field between the two hyperfine levels of the ground state. And this led to the optical detection of radio frequency resonances. But clearly also a nonlinear electromagnetic effect. The influence of essentially a nuclear susceptibility or electronic susceptibility by an optical field. A very useful application is the following, that if one saturates a transition between two spin levels which are not adjacent, but there is, say, another intermediate energy level. And these are the energy levels of the chromium spin, chromium 3 plus ion in ruby, which is sapphire with chromium impurity. And one equalizes the population of levels 2 and 4, and then one asks, what is the population of level 3? Now, on the one hand, level 3 likes to come equilibrium with level 2 and therefore acquire a smaller population than 2. And let's assume that that's the dominant relaxation mechanism. So 3 has a lower population than 2. But the pump has made the population of 2 and 4 equal. So level 3 has a lower population than level 4. And that is interesting. That is a so-called inverted population or negative temperature distribution. The energy level 4 with the higher energy has a higher population than level 3. So at the frequency nu 3-4, I get more stimulated emission than absorption, and therefore I get a useful output. And this is the microwave maser receiver utilized by Penzias and Wilson, who received the Nobel Prize for discovering the remnant microwave radiation from the Big Bang at 3 degrees Kelvin with this type of device. Note that the device works as a heat engine. There is a hot temperature provided by the pump. There is a cold temperature provided by the relaxation mechanism. And then there is a useful output at the frequency nu 3-4. Now, all this goes on exactly the same way in lasers. And it's a quirk of nature, of the history of science, that exactly the same material, chromium ions in sapphire, were used in the first laser. We now pump at a frequency which is roughly 10,000 times higher, a visible frequency in the blue and green. We have a fast relaxation mechanism to do these fluorescent levels of the chromium ion, and then we get the useful laser output at that frequency back to the ground state manifold. So, all masers and lasers essentially use such a multi-level pumping scheme. And once the ruby laser was there, the nonlinear effects became very plentiful in very short years. And the first one was done by Franken at the University of Michigan and co-workers, and that's the second harmonic generation of light. Indeed, a very simple experimental arrangement. One has this pulsed ruby laser. One takes a piezoelectric crystal to get a polarization quadratic in the light field amplitudes. One gets a polarization at the second harmonic frequency. This radiates at the second harmonic 2 omega. One filters out the fundamental frequency with a copper sulfate solution. And in the early first experiment, only one part in 10 to the 12th was converted from fundamental to second harmonic light. But there were 10 to the 18th photons to begin with, so one roughly had a million second harmonic photons. And that gives a signal in the ultraviolet, which is still very easily detectable. You see, if you take the second harmonic of red light, you get half the wavelength, you're already in the ultraviolet. So it's very striking. I might say that nowadays it's possible to convert 100% of the fundamental to the second harmonic with suitable arrangements. But let's first look at in a little more detail what happens at the boundary of this nonlinear crystal. Here we have an incident light beam traveling in a linear medium, an bromonaphthalene, which has an index of 1.6, higher than this piezoelectric crystal, so the light ray gets refracted away from the normal. That is not crucial, but it's interesting. And in the direction of this fundamental light beam in the nonlinear crystal, we create a second harmonic polarization. And we can now ask, in which direction is this second harmonic observed? And then, since the components of E and H tangential to the boundary have to be continuous at all points at all time, they have to be separately continuous for the second harmonic Fourier components. And since I have a polarization that has a very well-defined tangential wave vector, namely this distance, the only waves I can generate must have that same projection. Since I know the index of refraction at the second harmonic, I know the length of the wave vector or the wave number, and I can just circle them around, and where they cut this normal, that is where I have the possibility of radiating waves. And you find that there are three harmonic waves. There is a forced one in the direction of the second harmonic polarization, and then there are two solutions, additional solutions, so-called homogeneous solutions of the wave equation in this direction and in that reflected direction. And the amplitude of these two waves is, of course, just determined by the boundary condition that the second harmonic components of E and H along the boundary are continuous. And this leads then, in a very simple way, immediately to a generalization of the well-known laws of optics. And linear geometrical optics took a long time to develop. Law of reflection, angle of incidence is equal to angle of reflection, was recorded by Hero of Alexandria at first century after Christ's birth. 17 centuries later, Snell formulated the law that the ratio of the sines of angle of incidence and refraction had a certain ratio. And then, still 2 centuries later, Fresnel calculated on the basis of an elastic model of light what the intensities were. Now, it took my colleague Persian and me only 4 months. But, of course, what this slide doesn't show, that between Fresnel and the 1960s, there lived James Clerk Maxwell. And then, with Maxwell's equations, it becomes very simple to use a nonlinear constitutive relationship and crank out results. It's sort of amusing to compare this great compression in the historical development with one phenomenon where it took longer in the nonlinear case than in the linear case. And that is the phenomenon of conical refraction, which made Hamilton famous. Hamilton, in his time, predicted on the basis of Fresnel equations the phenomenon of conical refraction, 1833. It's only 3 years later that he wrote down the Hamiltonian. And at that time, that wasn't considered as important. This was considered so important that a fellow Irishman in Dublin, Lloyd, in the same year, 6 months later, verified the phenomenon of conical refraction. Now, we predicted the existence of ultraviolet cones when a red light gets into a crystal of suitably low symmetry, and since nonlinear phenomena clearly are always richer, we predicted 2 cones. And they were seen about 8 years later by my graduate student Anita Schell, now Mrs. Sorokin. The point that took so long and a student had plenty of time to get a PhD thesis out of it is that everybody else did much more important things, applications of quantum electronics and lasers, and the rather academic topic of conical refraction isn't as important as it was in the 1830s. How many more minutes do I have? 5, 10. Well, we have to hurry a little bit. Let me just say that there are clearly certain laws of conservation in nonlinear optics. Two we have already met. That's energy conservation. We shine 2 light quanta in, and we create a new quantum at the sum frequency. But that only goes efficiently if we at the same time match the momenta in the electromagnetic field. You see, the crystal remains transparent and doesn't take up any momentum or energy in this purely parametric process. And so we have, we would like to have delta K, the momentum mismatch, also equal to zero. Clearly, the number of photons is not conserved. We start out with two photons, take them away, and create one new photon. But what is conserved is what is known in the engineering trade as Menli-Rho relationships. And here they are written down. You see it's Poynting's vector divided by the photon energy. So it's essentially the photon flux density in beam 1 plus the photon flux density in beam 3 are constant. That means in order to get a photon at omega 3, I have to take one photon away at omega 1. And at the same time, I have to take away a photon at omega 2. Now, it is possible with certain tricks to quantitatively convert from one frequency to another. And you see, it's not as if you had random phases where you would get equipartition and the photon oscillators at the second and third harmonic would have equal energy, kT, as those in the fundamental. No, because of the phase relationships, one can start, say, with infrared radiation from a neodymium glass laser at 1.06 microns and convert 80% experimentally, theoretically up to 100% to the third harmonic in some tricky geometrical configurations so as to make use of the conservation of momentum and the Menli-Rho relationships I just discussed. Let's now go on to some spectroscopic applications, and Professor Shalov undoubtedly will say a great deal more about it. One takes a laser beam and shines it into an atomic vapor, and the line width is inhomogeneously broadened by the Doppler effect. And what this laser beam does, it eats a hole, now called digging a lamb dip, in the inhomogeneous distribution of Doppler frequencies. And one could probe that hole with a second laser beam, but laser people are frugal and don't have that much money. And so they use the same laser beam shining in the opposite direction. Then you see one laser beam digs a hole on the left side of the center and the other on the right side of the center because of the opposite velocities. But only when the laser beam is tuned to the exact center do these two laser beams compete with the same velocity packet in the Doppler distribution. And then you see a sharp feature which in the trade has become known as the lamb dip and or peak. And here is an example of that, a broad Doppler distribution and then a very sharp signal which has the natural line width because the inhomogeneous genius Doppler distribution has been eliminated, giving that very sharp spectral feature. Now we're going to show what happens on a detailed scale right at the top there. That was an infrared line of methane at 3.39 microns, about 10 to the 14 hertz. And you see, you can resolve features 1 kilohertz, so a precision of one part in 10 to the 11th. That's how sharp this line is defined. And if one uses this derivative curve, one can lock the laser to this atomic frequency. You see that there is a triplet, which is due to the very weak magnetic interaction between the nuclear spins of methane and the rotation of the molecule. In addition, each line is a doublet, which is essentially the recoil of the infrared photon on the molecule. It's a sort of Mössbauer effect in the infrared that becomes visible. Amounts to 1 kilohertz shift of the line. So extremely precise features. Then one can use these to use the laser as a frequency standard. And it is possible by an arrangement of nonlinear devices, first tungsten point contact diodes, and then later these nonlinear crystals, to multiply up the frequencies from the atomic frequency standards in the microwave region all the way to the visible. And we now know in absolute value the frequency of a few visible lines. At the same time, of course, one can measure the wavelengths of these visible lines in a Fabry-Perot interferometer, and by taking the comparison with frequency and wavelengths, one gets the speed of light. And here is the speed of light as accurately as it will ever be known. Because, you see, we have 10 decimal places, and that is better than the length standard is defined. So the proposal now is to define the velocity of light to that number, and you should learn it by heart, it will never change. And then, in order to measure a length, one takes a laser of known frequency and measures its wavelengths, and that's the Knuth's length standard. So lasers clearly are used in metrology, widespread applications. Now here is another scheme that is very useful to do non-Doppler broadened, Doppler-free spectroscopy of high resolution. It again uses two light beams going in opposite direction, so as to get zero momentum transfer. But in this case, one absorbs a photon going this way and a photon going that way. Suppose that the atom is at rest and that in this two-photon process, one reaches a highly excited state of an atom or a molecule with the same parity as the ground state. And the interesting thing is that one can do high-resolution spectroscopy. Because now let's consider an atom that doesn't stand still but has a velocity v. And then you see that the apparent frequency of one light beam gets downshifted by exactly the same amount as the apparent frequency of the other light beam gets upshifted. So in this two-photon process, all the atoms, regardless of the Doppler velocity, are simultaneously at resonance and give a sharp Doppler-free peak in the center. Well, my time is up. The general nonlinear susceptibility of third order gives you interactions between four light waves, in general, four frequencies, four wave vectors, four polarization directions, four amplitudes, four phases, very complex situations. And one can do a spectroscopy of that. And let me give one example of solid-state spectroscopy in sodium chloride. The interesting thing is that the material may be transparent at all four frequencies, incident and observed. And yet one sees dispersive features because one can have an intermediate resonance at either the difference frequency omega 1 minus omega 2 or at the sum frequency 2 omega 1. And these intermediate resonances lead to vast variations in the output at the combination frequency 2 omega 1 minus omega 2. And even though one uses only visible light, one sees features of infrared and ultraviolet dispersion. And I have misplaced my view graph. Oh, here it is on the dark table. And this is an example of nonlinear spectroscopy. Vertically, we plot the intensity of the new combination frequency, which also comes out in a new direction. And so this beam is very well defined, this new beam, as a function of two frequencies, 2 omega 1 horizontally, and one sees this very sharp resonance due to an ultraviolet exciton in cuprous chloride. At the same time, we can tune the second dye laser, frequency omega 2, so that omega 1 minus omega 2 gives a broad resonance in this direction. Oh, my God. That direction on the omega 1 minus omega 2 axis. And that's the infrared polariton of this crystal at 205 wave numbers. And one sees the interference of these intermediate resonances with one another and with nonlinear parts. And so there is a lot of infrared and ultraviolet nonlinear spectroscopy going on. So my time is up. Let me just mention one last effect, which is because Professor Wigner is in the audience, and that's the effect of time reversal with light beams. And here one has the degenerate situation that all the four light beams have the same frequency, but they are still distinguishable by their wave vector. And one has a forward strong pump beam in, one puts an ordinary mirror here, one gets a backward pump, then one comes in with an incident signal K2, and out comes a new wave in the backward direction, K4. And you see, one takes two photons away like that, creates two new photons going that way. Clearly, energy and momentum remain conserved. But, so what? I just put an ordinary mirror here, and I have the same effect. But this is a phase conjugate mirror. And if one writes down the amplitude of the force wave, the complex amplitude, you see it's proportional to this cubic expression of the three incident amplitudes, trilinear. And you see it's proportional to E2 star. That means that the phase of this force wave is also inverted in sign, and not only the wave vector. So at any point in space, one has the opposite phase. Since this is a real field, of course, the real field consists of this complex amplitude with this change in sign of the k vector and the phase, and its complex conjugate. And if you look at the complex conjugate, I really have changed the time of t. So it's a phase conjugate, a time-reversed wave. That means if the phase of the wave 2 is distorted by coming through the atmosphere or a not perfect optical medium, I get here this distorted wavefront. Now, on the phase conjugation, the wave 4 has just the opposite phase at that point, travels back through the same medium, and comes back out here as a perfect plane wave. And that is, of course, very interesting. So the phase conjugate mirror has real applications. Here you see it again. If you have an ordinary mirror, you get a point source and you get a divergent light beam from the mirror. But with this phase conjugate mirror, you shine the light back exactly to the point where it came from. This is also an example of real-time holography. One can say one produces an amplitude and or a phase grading by the forward pump and the signal, and then one reads out that grading with the backward pump to give the phase conjugate wave. So also real-time holography. I could go on, I won't, my time is up. There are many applications, and some more in spectroscopy you will hear from my colleague Archalov. Thank you.